This is the big questions class. What we're going to be doing in here is talking about the kinds of questions that either keep people from believing in God or in faith, or are objections to Christianity, or they're questions that a lot of times we as Christians are afraid to ask. So questions that we maybe have of the scriptures, but we don't, of something we see in the Bible or something we see in the world, but we don't really want to ask. And the kind of exciting thing about this class is I don't want to presume I know what questions you guys would like me to talk about. So I'm not going to talk about 35 questions, but I've given you 35 questions. And I'd like for you to pick from this list the top questions that you have. So this will take a little bit of time. It's totally fine. This is a big part of the class. But and if you don't want to participate, if you'd like the rest of the class to set the agenda, that's totally fine. But we'd love, I would love to hear which questions actually are the most relevant to you. And if I left a question off that you think, this is one I really want to talk about, that's why there's five blanks at the bottom. However, what I'll say is if you have a question that's not on the list that you want us to talk about, you're going to have to kind of champion it among the people around you. So a few people put it down, because obviously I won't be able to talk about every question that people put down, but if there's one that stands out that I forgot, then I'll definitely add it to the list. There's no question that we're going to shy away from. There's no question you can't ask in here. So that's the whole point of this study. So I'm going to give you a few minutes to look at the list. You can check as many as 10. Try not to check any more than that, so that it's a reasonable list for us to get through. And if you want to prioritize them, if there's one or two that you say, I want to make sure this one is marked as the most important, you can do that. If not, you can just check off as many as you would love to discuss. Okay? So I'll give us a few minutes to do that.
So depending on the questions,
yes.
You might do two in a session.
Yeah, so I'll talk a little bit about that. But in terms of flow, I may spend 2 weeks on one question. I may spend 1 week on two questions. It all just depends on the size of the question and how long it takes to adequately address.
So if we're recruiting for your Sunday session, they set their own?
They will be able to give their own feedback, just like you will. And I'll probably try to coordinate somewhat, so I'm not completely on different schedules. But yeah, they'll do the same thing you are. I'm doing this again on Sunday morning. So, okay. So some of you are going to have your faith shaken just by reading this list, right? You're like, oh my goodness, I didn't want to remember that all these questions were real. I'm sure I'm going to get some fun write-ins from people like Jim. So we're not going to do where did Cain get his wife. So I'm not going to do that one. I will mention a couple of. So I ran this list by one of our staff members. And two of the things that she suggested I wanted to mention, just because I know it's unlikely that there'd be write-ins the same unless we kind of mention them. But one of them was kind of what's the relationship between Christians and politics or the state? So there's a lot of questions that could kind of be around that subject. Should Christians have certain political leanings is one? Should Christians be absent from politics? You know, that kind of a thing. So I'll throw that out there just to kind of ask if you if you're interested in that. And then another one was in terms of stewarding the earth, what's our responsibility and how should Christians respond to, you know, things that come up like climate change or you know, the use of resources. How should Christians be responding to that as those that see ourselves as God's stewards? So if one of those seems a high priority to you, then you can pencil that in.
How did you come up with this list?
This list? Yeah. So most of the questions on this list are either standard questions that apologists talk about with non-believers, or they're typical objections that Christians wrestle with, either in kind of figuring out things that they see in the Bible, or how should they understand the authority of Scripture, things like that, or just in the world, right? So there are questions on there about other religions and about whether salvation, how salvation is going to available for those who've never heard the gospel. Is that are they just without hope? You know, things like that. So
some of us were hoping that you'd dealt with this at Yale, so that we would kind of be on their level.
Well, yeah. So I don't know that I'll ever get you, George, to their level.
Oh.
Just kidding, George. No, I don't. They're a bunch of teenagers,
Yale,
so. but I would say a pretty good number of these I've spoke on at Yale. Yeah.
So could we get graduate credit?
Are you working towards a degree?
Is that,
okay. I'll look into it. I'll look into it.
He wants to be superintendent someday.
Yeah. I don't think Yale has a superintendent, so.
List of 35 questions.
Do you? Okay. Okay. Well, you can keep working on that. We're gonna go ahead and get started. But yeah, you can keep looking through that. If you're not done, feel free to keep going on that. So I want to talk about, well, why are we doing this? What's the point of looking at all these questions? And there's really three goals that I have for this study. First is, I think it's always helpful for us to think deeply and biblically about questions that cause people doubt, even if some of these aren't your doubts, but that can create distance between us and God. And so several of these questions, I know, in just talking to Christians and discipling people, have given people hesitation about their affections for God. Maybe there's something that they just, to them, doesn't seem good about God from what they see on the pages of Scripture. Or maybe it's something, it's a fairness issue. They don't think God has been fair in certain ways. And that can create distance where we don't appreciate God in the way that we're designed to. And so as far as we can, we want to think deeply and biblically. Now, we know that, you know, there's lots of things that God doesn't fully answer in the Bible. There's lots of things that we in our finite understanding will not fully understand. But God has told us to apply our hearts to wisdom. He's told us to seek these kinds of things out. And so we should do our best to answer these. So I hope that it will help you get closer to God. That's really what this point is that by dealing with some of these objections, maybe some of them have been splinters kind of in your mind about, I don't get this about God. Maybe those can be removed and there can be some healing there. The second is, I want to help you build confidence and enthusiasm for engaging others in spiritual discussions. So a lot of these questions are things that will come up the first time you have a conversation with somebody who doesn't believe in God or doesn't believe in Jesus, at least. They'll say, well, you know, I would believe in Jesus, but think of all the horrible things Christians have done. Or I would believe in Jesus, but the Bible's full of errors, right? And so if you don't have a basic way of responding to those questions, a lot of times you can feel like, well, we didn't get very far. We kind of got stalled there. Now, a lot of those times, that's not really the obstacle to faith for that person. But it is a legitimate hurdle that they're putting out there, even if it's kind of a red herring. In other words, they're chasing something that doesn't really mean that much to them. It's a legitimate kind of question. And so by giving you these questions and kind of giving you a handout for each one that you can come back to, I'm hopeful to say that you will re-engage with people about their faith and about maybe what keeps them from believing. One of the greatest ways to share your faith is just to be a really good listener and listening to how other people see the world, how they've wrestled with these issues, what they think what stands in their way to belief. And as you do that, you'll encounter a lot of these kinds of issues. And then the third one is a really important one, and that's to develop empathy and compassion for others with different views. So nobody in this room probably is struggling with all of these questions, right? And some of you may not be struggling with many of them at all, but other people are. And by thinking deeply about this, we begin to kind of feel the pain of others that are wrestling with this, or that this is a legitimate obstacle to them loving God the way that they want to, or believing in Him at all. And I hope that it makes you more empathetic. A lot of times Christians can share truth in a way that does not convey that I care about your point of view. I know the truth, and I'm ready to give it to you, but I'm not really compassionate about all the reasons that you haven't embraced that. And so by thinking about these questions, I do think it expands our heart to say, wow, there are some things that are really emotionally challenging, that are really difficult to discern, that people may be wrestling with, and I need to listen to them. I need to know what's going on in their life. So I pray that in addition to drawing us closer to God, in addition to giving us some boldness and enthusiasm about talking to other people, it also makes you a more compassionate person towards people that are wrestling with these questions and struggling with objections to faith. Okay? All right, so you decide the questions, okay? So I'm going to compile these lists, and we're going to do the ones that are most important to you. I'll get to have a little bit of input into that, so I'll put my own list together. But I'm not going to pick the list. I'm going to let the room pick the list. And the reason that's good is really regionally, all across the world, you'd be surprised how different the objection questions are. So it's great to actually hear what this particular community is struggling with, and for me to address that instead of just whatever standard list is out there. Okay? All right. So what are we going to do today? Right? I don't have a question. So what are we going to do today? Well, George seems to want us to do something that's worthy of Yale. And so that's what we're going to do. So I hope I don't scare anybody off. But we're gonna do a little groundwork that in the world that we live in is just necessary work, okay? So this, if you haven't been in college for a long time or in high school, this might be a little bit heavy lifting. So don't get scared off by that, because this is, I think, if you stay with me in this conversation, it will be very helpful. How many of you in the room look at the world and think people have just lost their mind, okay? All right, now, I know that's a silly question, but legitimately, raise your hand if you really look at the world that way. Okay? Okay? So, I think this is a common Christian sentiment, and there's a reason for it, okay? There's a reason for it. People have not just lost their mind, but what's happened is the most basic underpinnings about what knowledge is, about what truth is, have been shifting for the last 100 years, and it's finally really fully caught up to us in America. This happened in Europe 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago. It helped lead to World War I and World War II. Some of you may know some of that intellectual history, but this stuff happened a long time ago in some parts of the world. In some parts of the world, it still hasn't happened, but in the United States, it's happened since the 1960s to now. It's been happening. And so one of the reasons I think Christians, if you have a Christian worldview, if your worldview has been shaped by the Bible and being raised in the church, and you look at the world and you're just like, what on earth is going on, is because it's such a seismic shift away from things like, who am I? Questions like, who am I? What's the meaning of life? Is there anything that's true out there? These are the questions, right? They're not big questions. They're the questions of life. And the shift that's happened in the last 50 years on those kinds of issues has left Christians really, I think, in some ways, not understanding where the world is, okay? So before we get started, we have to talk about what is that? What has happened there? And it comes down to this particular question more than anything else, and that is, how do we know things? And what I mean is not how our brain functions, but how do we have certainty in things being true or right or correct, Okay? So if you were to answer that question, what would you say? How do you know things?
Books.
Okay, I've read about them. Okay? Oh, man.
I'm sorry.
The internet. That's sad but true. That's sad but true. Yeah, we all do it. Yeah.
Experience.
Experience, okay.
Observation.
Okay, so our senses, right? Yeah.
Discipline.
Discipline. So you've been taught it through someone else's discipline, yeah. Heritage, okay. So you stand in a tradition of others, yeah. Okay, anything else?
Faith.
Faith, okay. Faith is a way of knowing. Okay, so this is the foundational question that really separates Christians from the world right now, more than almost anything else. The culture has moved away from any kind of foundational metaphysical reality. Now, metaphysics just means everything, okay? So if I'm trying to explain what's behind everything, not just the natural world, but love and people and ethics and everything, for the most part, there's no theory that anybody has any stock in anymore in the secular world. There's no metaphysical theory that anybody believes in. And that's left a kind of groundlessness that has not been true of the West until the last 100 years or so. So the study of how you know things is actually a real thing, okay? It's called epistemology. And if you study philosophy in college, you'll get to epistemology really early. And it comes from two words, episteme, which is Greek, which means knowledge, and then logos, a word that you probably have heard, which means word, but it also means logical discourse or study of, right? And so this is the study of knowing, okay? The study of knowing. How do we know things? And so my working definition of epistemology is the investigation of what distinguishes rational belief from opinion, okay? What distinguishes somebody believes something rationally and rightly and justifiably versus it's just an opinion, it's just some thought in their head, there's no grounding for it, okay? That's epistemology. And inside that study of epistemology, there's more than 100 subgroups of how people ground what they believe, okay? How people ground it as rational or justifiable. So what we're going to do in this intro, and I'm going to go slow, okay? Because I know this is not normally what you guys talk about, you know, when you're sitting around the dinner table. But we're going to talk about some very important kinds of epistemology, kinds of understanding how do I come to know things that you need to understand if you're talking to a 21st century person that's not grown up exactly like you, okay? You just need to understand this stuff. So how do we acquire belief? So the first thing that an epistemologist would want to know is how do I get beliefs in the first place? So let's table the fact that they are rational or justified. How do I even get them? And there's really two ways, okay? It's called a priori, which just means before thinking, right? So prior to experience through reason. So you may have a belief, for example, that the world exists. Okay, and that belief likely precedes you experiencing it. It's not grounded by that. Or maybe another example would be, that God exists is a a priori belief for a lot of people. They just, there's got to be a God. So I haven't experienced him yet, but there's got to be one, right? So for a lot of people, that is prior to experience. Now, most of our beliefs are actually the second category, a posteriori, which means after experience, right? Or after either some empirical or rational way I've come to believe this, okay? So we acquire things either through rationally kind of processing what we're seeing and what we're thinking, or we come to it a priori. Now, for the most part, a priori beliefs are pure rational ideas, okay, for the most part. So they're ideas that are like 1 + 1 = 2, okay? I don't have to prove that. I don't have to experience 1 + 1 = 2. It just makes sense to me. So the rational ideas that kind of you presuppose are in your mind or make sense to you before you've experienced anything or before it has to be proven to you are usually in this category. And then empirical beliefs or, things that you experience through sense or through testimony of others or through your community are here. So, like I said, most things we come to believe because of what we've experienced. But there is a pretty big set of beliefs that we experienced before it's proven through experience. Okay?
I got a question.
Yeah.
Which one does domestication fall under?
Domestication. What yeah. What do you mean by
well,
domestication?
We're pretty much domesticated, kind of like we do our dogs.
Yeah, so that's more of a habit. So that's more talking about our behaviors than it is about our thinking. So what I would say is a thought like, where did we come from, right? That's an a priori thought. In other words, I don't need to experience reality to ask that question as a rational being. Where did I come from? Okay? So habits and behaviors is a different study altogether, and that's grouped into anthropology and sociology and some other things. Yeah. Yes?
I guess I also would ask or think there are a lot of people who never question what they believe.
Yes.
So I grew up this way.
Right.
And because mom and dad believed it, grandparents believed it, I believe it, it must be true, and I don't question.
So. Yes, yeah. So what I would say is that doesn't necessarily mean that belief originally came to you by pure rationalism. It probably came to you actually by experience. Somebody told you it was true, right? That's an experience. So personal testimony or instruction is something we've experienced, and because I got that instruction from what I consider a reputable source, I trusted it holistically without my own investigation. But that's still, I gained that belief through experience. I didn't have it in my mind, which is pure rationalism. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. So how does a belief get justified? So there's really two groups that they group it into, and that is that the internalist school of epistemology says that justifying conditions are within the mind. So what this is saying is that the reason, everything that you need to decide if this is justified or not is not actually external to you, it's just psychological, okay? So an internalist would say, why do you believe your parents love you, okay? It's not actually the sequence of events that's happened to you externally that's proven it. It's the psychological construct that you've built around them and how you associate that to the concept of love. It's in your mind, right? So philosophers from Descartes to Kant wrestled back and forth between these two about which one is it? Do we ground truth by stuff that happens outside of us, or do we ground truth by solely the fact that we've decided to catalog it this way in our mind? Does that make sense? Okay, so this is the discussion between internalism, all justifying conditions to say this belief is valid, is within the mind, versus externalism, that the conditions to justify the belief are external to the mind. Now, where does this come up for Christians? Well, it comes up all the time in discussions. Why do you believe in Jesus? The historicity of the resurrection. The Bible has proven itself to be true, and it's a reliable document, blah, blah, blah. What kind of a person is that? That's an externalist, right? That's a person who is justifying that belief by things that are outside of himself. That says, this is why it's good for me. This is why it's rational for believe it. Now, does that person not have any internalist experience? Of course they do, right? But they don't feel like that's a viable way to justify that belief. But how do most Christians justify that belief in God or belief in Christ?
Internalist.
Most Christians would say, well, I've had an encounter with God. I've experienced him. And as I read the Bible, God spoke to me, or some sort of semblance of that. Or God convicted, the Spirit convicted me of my sin, and he walks with me. And well, all of that, right, is saying it's justifiable because of internal constructs. Now, can you be somebody who does both? Absolutely, right? Especially in different areas of truth. You could say, well, when it comes to my biology lab, I'm an externalist. But when it comes to if my husband loves me, I'm an internalist, right? I totally go by how I'm feeling about that. And of course, your husband might want you to say, I did these four things for you. Of course I love you, right? But you're an internalist. I'm like, no, I don't feel loved. Like, so you didn't do it. Okay. So how is a belief justified? Okay, so these are two schools, and this is what they discuss. So So philosophers would say, which one of these is better? And there are different schools of thought, and it creates branches, right, of epistemology. Now you think, well, these are all a bunch of ivory tower people talking about this stuff. Nobody cares. This shapes culture. It does. Because what happens is these ideas come out, somebody becomes dominant in, just like evolution did in biology, right? It becomes a dominant idea, and this is a better explaining power idea, and then it trickles down, and then it enters media, and it enters the shaping narratives of authors and all kinds, right? So this is not just trivial stuff. Now, it takes a long time for that to happen, especially in America. In Germany, it happened in like 5 years every time. But here, it takes like 100 years before reigning ideas actually become kind of in the water, right? In academy ideas. So anyway, so they discuss this kind of stuff. And there's no school that's like clearly the winner here. I'm just saying that those are two schools of thought. Okay, so like I said, there's over 100 epistemologies out there that you could learn and study, and most of them are really boring. But we're going to talk about ones that are incredibly important for you to understand. Why? Because they're held by most of the people you know, right, in some form or fashion, and they're practiced. So this is how people come to have confidence that they know something, okay? This is what we're talking about. So the first one is empiricism. Now, this is the easiest one to understand, that justified belief comes from experience, especially the five senses, right? So this is rooted in the 18th century. Some very big guys wrote about this, and it was very compelling because cold rationalism, which we're going to talk about later, was kind of dying out because we started to think of ideas like the movie The Matrix, right? What if we're all just dreaming this? and when those ideas crept in, people started to say, well, cold rationalism isn't enough to ground reality. And so other schools started to come out, and one of the most successful was empiricism, okay? Empiricism just says, the way I justify belief is I touch it, I see it, and if you think this one's not alive and well, good grief. I mean, it's everywhere. That's the only way something becomes real to me. This is Doubting Thomas, right? This is seeing is believing. This is that school of thought. Matter of fact, seeing and believing is an exact statement of this epistemology, isn't it? So I come to believe things through experience. Now, that experience through the senses includes things like, I heard a really brilliant guy who was educated at Yale tell me something. I was not educated at Yale, so I'm not talking about myself. Tell me something, and I believed it because he had good credentials and all of that, right? Because that came to me through hearing, and my assessment that was a reliable testimony, okay? So that would be empiricism. Scientism. This is a reduced version of empiricism that's become popular in the last 40 years or so, but it justifies belief coming through the assumptions and methods of science, okay? So let me give you one example of this. Evolutionary theory, right, which has become really popular in biology. People have applied evolutionary thought to every discipline out there. Psychology, every discipline you can imagine, right? There's one guy who even thinks about the evolution of ideas. His name's Hegel. The evolution of ideas as ideas get more and more, so like an idea like socialism becomes communism, becomes anarchism, whatever, he'll track that progression and show how it's evolution that's done that, okay? So scientism is that kind of commitment to the scientific method, the way that they build their set of assumptions, the way that they test things through the scientific method, and so on and so forth. Now, this is really foolish as an all-encompassing epistemology. And the people that you see that hold to this are usually the radical militant atheists, okay? So they hold things that the scientific method has nothing to say about up to that standard. If you want me to believe that, then this is what you've got to do. And another philosopher can point that out and be like, yeah, that's totally illegitimate. You don't do that with the fact that your parents love you, the fact that you have a bond between your kids. You don't measure that in a beaker, right, and decide that that's real. You believe that's real just as much as you believe the sun is real. In other words, you don't use that standard of knowledge as much as you're trying to force it on us as the only way to validate truth. But it's out there. Scientism is out there. and we'll talk about where and how. The second one is kind of a blend of these two, okay? And it's really common. It's called, you may have heard this term before, it's called logical positivism. But it's justifying belief that says it's either got to be empirically verified, right, up here, or it's got to be logical, which means, logical in philosophical terms means like 1 plus 1 equals 2. In other words, basic math and logic dictates that that's true, or I've got to be able to sense it, you know, through the way science would sense it. This is really common. In other words, and we'll talk about this, but if it doesn't fit into this category, it's sketchy, right? That's a very common perspective on the world right now, is if it's like you show it to me in an equation, right, or you can show it to me in a lab, great. Otherwise, it's hearsay. Right? I mean, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's out there in full force, logical positivism. So where do we see these points of view the most? We see it in the academy, right? We see it in places where people are saying, we want truth, and we want them based on what we can see, taste, touch, hear, and we want it based on logic, okay? Now, is that okay that the academy is full of that worldview? It's okay as far as they understand that restriction is not universal, it's applied here because it's a benefit with the type of studying we're doing. Like, for example, is it a benefit that your doctor says, I'm not gonna think about all the religious views out there when I'm trying to heal you, I'm not gonna think of all the philosophies of medicine that exist, I'm just gonna think about what I learned in medical school. Yeah, that's helpful, because this is a narrow thing. But if he says, that way of deciding if a truth is valid or not is the only way to decide if truth is valid or not, then that's horrible in his whole life, right? Because that's very useful when I'm thinking about what's causing you to be sick. It's not very useful when I say nothing is true unless I can prove it in the same way I proved that you were sick by this germ, right? And that's what's happened. And so you see it in the academy. It's not bad that it's there. In other words, we shouldn't hate the fact that they make you study the scientific method. They make you learn logic. They make you become a good person at practicing science when you're taking, you know, the study of anything, right? That's fine. But just don't apply that as a worldview for all truth. And that's what's happened, isn't it? Or is what happens to a lot of people. So if you ask, why do people go to college and lose their faith? Well, a lot of people suspect it's these militant professors, faith busters. Well, there's like 50 of those for every million professors, right? It's not that. But it is the fact that they begin to learn stuff deeply for the first time in particular areas, and it's by looking for data according to these epistemologies, right? That we're gonna fine-tune our ability to sense things, our ability to rationalize them, and our ability to rule out things that are outside the pale of our senses. And then they start saying, well, what did I learn in church? Right? Okay? So that's not bad, because they need to do that if they're learning biology, right? They shouldn't be learning. And this is where I disagree with ID. I think ID's got some great things to say about intelligent design, but that's philosophy, right? It's philosophy to say, I believe that if you look holistically at all that was created, it tells of a designer. That's a philosophical statement. It's not traditional science, is it? We're not in a lab doing that. I can't test if a designer did something in a lab. I'm trying to figure out if it passes this test or not. So the problem is we don't understand their epistemologies there, do we? So what we should be arguing for, instead of your biology textbook should have ID in it, intelligent design is what I'm talking about there, we should be saying you should teach philosophy and religion, because that's a huge part of life, right? You should teach philosophy. You should teach people that epistemologies are different depending on what you're studying and what part of life you're in, and you can't always just rely on your senses. We should teach this kind of thing so that they're prepared for, oh yeah, this is what we're doing here, but this doesn't apply to all of life. Does that make sense? Okay. So they're right in the objection that our education has become very narrowly scientific instead of, we don't teach the big, you know, it used to be, the religion used to be the queen of the sciences. Did you know that? It used to be called the queen of the sciences. Why? Because your conclusions about God and the universe and all these other things shaped so much about the way you understood everything else, right? That it was queen. It had a bigger impact on everything than biology did. That's why they called it that. But now we kind of regulate that to, well, you learn that at church, and we're not going to teach philosophy. So anyway, that's a big problem. Okay, next, rationalism. So justified belief is verified through innate or intuitive reasoning. Okay, so I alluded to the fact that empiricism sprung when rationalism started to suffer, right? Rationalism began with a guy named Descartes. You guys remember Descartes? Have you heard that name? Some people remember Cartesian coordinates from math, but that's not what he's really about. He was a philosopher that at the beginning of the Enlightenment was trying to say, let's ground truth, okay? Let's ground truth and not just have the fact that we know things because we've been taught them, right? Let's have it, we know them because we've applied our minds to seek out the foundations, and then we've built on those foundations. That was kind of his design. And most of you have heard Descartes' first conclusion when he was looking for the bedrock of what things are not doubtable. And that is, anybody know that statement? Yeah? I think, therefore I am, right? So he grounded, I have to exist because I can think. Now, he also knew that my senses could be misleading me. He knew my eyes could be tricked, right? And if they could be tricked once, then they could be lying to me all the time. I can't be 100% positive that my eyes correspond to reality. But the fact that I can think about what my eyes are seeing, that tells me I'm something. I'm something because I'm able to muse about it. So that's what I think, therefore I am. Is the second indubitable, undoubtable truth he came up with was, nobody knows this one, God exists, ironically, right? God must exist, right? You can't really doubt that. And that's because of first causes and the fact that anything exists, there must be something behind it. And so whatever God is, he has to be there. Anyway, that was his second indubitable truth. Anyway, so that gave rise to the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, all of these things that happened that changed the Western world. Well, that fell on hard times, and empiricism kind of rose up. But then there was a renewal of rationalism under some guys like John Locke and others that said, you know what? Our senses can be completely fooled, which Descartes had already said a long time before. So we shouldn't really trust in empiricism. And so guys like Kant and John Locke and others have a new kind of version of rationalism that says, you know, what's true is because we just know it's true. Right? There's certain things I could say to you, like human beings are different than animals. And you'd be like, well, that's true. I mean, you could debate about how they're different, but they're different, right? And I don't need to have that tested. I just know that. It's just intuitive. It's innate. This school of thought was saying that's the best way to ground things. Is just, we'll ground the things that we know for sure just through our own innate ability to reason. Skepticism is the opposite response to rationalism, right? And so empiricism's out. I can't trust my senses, but I can trust the things that I just innately know, okay? Well, skeptics are like, nope, if you can't trust empiricism, you can't trust anything. You can't know anything. So we're all just doing the best we can, but the truth is there's no foundation. There's nothing that's knowable. Okay, so from a philosophical standpoint, skepticism is there is no known reality. You know, we all have our own opinions and perceptions, but none of us know the truth. And then this one is the queen of them because it's everywhere now, relativism. And that is justification of belief is relative to the mental construct of each person. So you have a history, you have your own mind, you have your own set of experiences. You have a story that allows you to justify truth, and it's unique to you. And so that should not be criticized or imposed upon anybody else because they have their own relative construct of truth, right? Does that make sense? So truth can be justified, but it's justified within either one society or one mind as the construct of how they've come to know that thing. It's not justifiable outside of that one mind or that one group. So where do we see these points of view? Everywhere other than natural sciences, just about. Everywhere else, people are in these three camps. Now, rationalism is not typically found in religion, but it's found in lots of political theory, it's found in lots of sociology theory, where people just think innately this is true, right? And they just make kind of bold statements like that. Like communism is evil, right? Or whatever. And they don't justify it, they don't act like that's relative to my history. They just say that's innately true, right? And then skepticism is just massive. We'll talk about that more. And then relativism, yeah.
You say where people are, you know, they say whether they're in all of these camps. Should we be in one of these camps?
We're going to talk about that. Oh. We're going to talk about what, is there a Christian perspective? We'll talk about that, yeah. But you need to know these fields of view because these are out there live, and you start talk to somebody, and you give them wonderful insight into one of these questions that they're wrestling with, and one of their responses is, well, I'm glad that works for you. Like, well, what were we talking about? And you realize, well, they only value an epistemology of relativism. In other words, if they don't come to this through their own experience and construct of their own frames of thought, they think it's invalid. So you have an epistemological battle with that person now, not a battle to show them that belief is rational, right? Yeah?
Yes, but as we enter into conversation, should we know how we interpret data?
So we haven't gotten to any question yet. When we get to a question, we'll talk about how do I talk about this with somebody to help them understand.
Well, I mean, internally, should I know how I would think, I would interpret that?
Yeah.
Would I be a rationalist, a skeptic?
Yeah,
a
yeah,
relative?
Yeah.
I mean, I should know what I
yes,
mean.
Yeah. So when it comes to our understanding of metaphysics and God and those kinds of things, there is a particular epistemology that's put forward in Scripture that's been defended through the ages of how we know certain things. And we're going to talk about that at the end. But so, yes, you should know, but you also need to know who I'm talking to. And when you detect they're not coming from that and we're on different, you'll talk past each other the rest of the time unless you address that. Unless you say, oh, you know, they're a relativist. And they're relativist extreme sometimes. I mean, I've had people do that with me with science. You know, like I'll talk to them about what's happening in space and they'll be like, well, I know you believe that, but I'm kind of into astrology. Like, I'm not talking about astrology. I'm talking about what's happening in no, but I don't go for that. You know, we're talking about science. What are you talking about? And it's just an extreme version of relativism, right? That I'm on my own journey and I come to these things on my own. And you're just like, well, do that, but that makes no sense in certain fields, right?
They usually say.
So, okay. All right, so now there's two more I'm going to point out because they've been very important to Christians over the centuries. One is called foundationalism, and foundationalism is a great epistemology, but it's fallen on hard times in recent years because of the strength of relativism. So relativism is the dominant view, not just because of the history of philosophy, but because of postmodernism, and we're not going to get able to talk about that, but The modern era produced a lot of misery, right? It produced two world wars. It produced the most number of people killed by other human beings in the history of the world. It produced the Great Depression. You know, it produced some really bad stuff globally, and that was kind of the unexpected end of we're going to go as far as empiricism and science can take us. And what did we produce at the end? The atomic bomb and people that were trying to breed people out because they believed evolution, right? That's what we ended up with. And there was a disenfranchisement of that, and so a whole other set of philosophies kind of emerged, transcendentalism and romanticism and all these other things. And all of those really started to lead into what's called postmodern thinking. And postmodern thinking is highly relative, okay? So the postmodernist is finding meaning within their own little individualistic bubble in the West, okay? So this is not universal across the globe, but in the West, Europe and here, and places that are influenced predominantly by the West, yeah, we're predominantly individualistically making meaning, right, for ourselves. Let me give you a great example of this, modern art. Why did art all of a sudden go nuts for a while, right? What happened there? It's like we were for a while. It's still gone nuts, right? But we were making stuff more and more real. And then what happened? Well, the first stage was stuff like impressionism. So we're making things less real intentionally so that it will have an emotional impact on you, right? Okay, I got that stage. I kind of like that, right? But then where do we go? Cubism and modern art. Well, what are we doing? Well, I'll tell you what they were doing. They were reading philosophers. They were reading about meaningless. They were reading guys like Nietzsche. And they were saying, how do I represent the fact that there is no meaning, there is no God, there is no any of that anymore? It's all just what you want it to be, because that's what they really believed about reality. Well, I'll make something like a big white thing with six dots on it, and you get to decide what that means. That's what that is. Figure it out. And there's no right answer. Good luck with that. I just made it. That's what art did, and that's what music did. That's what literature did. In literature, they call that reader response interpretation. And they read the Bible that way at places like Yale, where they say, there is no meaning in the text, and there's no way for me to access the brain of whoever wrote this, so I can't know what he was intending. So all that it means is whatever it says to me. It's called reader response interpretation. That's the main way they read the Bible in secular universities now. What does it say to you? Well, this is a Korean, feminist reading, because I happen to be female and Korean. And it says whatever I want to say. Well, that's valid. Why? Because you're the reader, and that's where meaning is created. Where did that all come from? It all came from radical relativism, okay? Radical relativism that crept in. Okay, so that's an example, but what preceded that was foundationalism, and that is that some beliefs are foundational and don't necessarily require justification. So one of the giants in foundationalism was Kant, okay? And it wasn't necessarily that he wanted to be that, Immanuel Kant. But when he saw that empiricism wasn't reliable and cold rationalism wasn't reliable, because maybe we're not discerning the universe properly at all, it created an existential crisis for him. He's like, how do I ground reality? How do we have meaning? And what he did was to say, there are certain things about the way I interpret the universe that are foundational that I think we can just all agree on, and that'll give us a starting point. So I'm not going to give you all of his little bins like that, but one of them was cause and effect. This is a really easy one to establish. He's like, my empirical, like, let's say we're watching a game of pool, and my empirical faculties by the sounds and the things that are happening tells me when that ball moved, it's the impact that that ball had to that ball that caused it to move, right? That's cause and effect. And what he started to do is he said, human beings, as they look at the universe, they do that with everything they see and do, and that's the way our brain works. It's just a bin. We always, anything we see, we always associate, well, what caused that, right? That's just one of the things. So cause and effect is a foundational truth that we can just accept, right? Everything has a cause, and we can accept that. And even if we're wrong about it, we're all wrong, and we're so universally wrong that there's no way for us to go justify that cause and effect is real. And the interpretive power that it has of the whole universe, believing that cause and effect is real, is vast, right? It helps me understand tons of things, and it seems to be working. So we're just going to accept it. I don't have to go prove cause and effect in the lab, okay? So foundationalism was getting really close to, I think, a biblical epistemology. And really, it reigned from the 18th century to post-World War I. Foundationalism was the reigning kind of idea. But foundationalism in postmodernism, when all truth is relative, right, fell on hard times. Because even these kind of foundational truths, well, cause and effect, right? Well, maybe, but maybe we're just in a big computer program. And there is no cause and effect, it's just electrons. Whatever, you know. So, I mean, those kinds of things were being talked about, and they moved to kind of post-foundationalism. And one of the most brilliant philosophers who's ever lived, Alvin Plantinga, he's a very strong Christian at Notre Dame. He came up with Reformed epistemology, which is basically just dealing with all of the conversations that were happening since the 1950s, post-foundationalism. To reclaim foundationalism for religion particularly. And he did it so well that none of the secular philosophers could argue with it. So he's just an important name to know, because he saved theism as a legitimate belief in the world of philosophy in the academy. Him and a few others, of course. He's not by himself, but mainly he did that. So Reformed epistemology is a response to kind of the radical relativism, but it's a new version of foundationalism. Okay, so let me do a couple more examples before I completely lose everybody. So what's the state of our secular West? Well, just real quick, I'm gonna just say this. When it comes to thinking about the natural world, right, we have an approach out in the world, the secular West, okay? So I'm not talking about in the church. The church has got different perspectives on some of these things. But in the natural world, we have radical scientism and empiricism, okay? When you're gonna make conclusions about the natural world, anything other than a scientific method or what you can see, taste, touch, and hear is not allowed, right? That's where we are. So if there's somebody who is a creationist, it's not as if that person is hated or militantly opposed, but he just has no place in the discussion, right? It's like, if you're going to take that approach, then, I mean, you can be a creationist, you just can't talk about it with us, right? Because we're not going to talk about that, okay? So when it comes to anything related to the natural world, for the most part, in our cultures in the West, you do that through scientism and empiricism. When it comes to ideology, so things like politics or how to raise a family or whatever, right? Well, there's some gut instinct rationalism that happens, but most of it is relativism, okay? Most of it is, well, what works for you may not work for us. So you guys got to figure that out on your own. You have your own ideologies about whatever when it comes to just ideologies. Ethics and religion, radical skepticism, we've seen that, you know. In other words, you should doubt anything that a religious authority teaches you. You should doubt it, you should question it, you should push back on it. And then relativism again, right? There's lots of perspectives, and so they're all valid. They're all unique to you. You have your own story. You've got to find your own truth. Metaphysics, which is what grounds all of reality? Well, the honest truth is most people don't think anything grounds all of reality, and that's experientialism. In other words, whatever I experience is valid. There's no overarching, story or anything like that. And then relativism again, right? In other words, whatever story you want to come up with, or whatever metaphysical narrative speaks to you is great. So what does that produce? It produces this as kind of a summary of where the world is right now. There's no absolute truth except what's available through science or logic. That's absolute, which is ironic, right? Because you can't do both. But that's how they function, right? You can show me the science, then I believe it. Now, what's ironic about that is science is rarely precise. In other words, it's constantly changing. Scientific conclusions are changing all the time in most fields. It's rarely precise, but that's the only area of truth that we now say, at least I got a bedrock there, right? At least I can believe what the macrobiologist is telling me and what the doctor's telling me, because those guys have truth in those areas, and I can just trust that. Whereas any other area, there's not really any truth. It's all, you find your own truth, right? You discover your own truth. Okay, so understand that this narrative has happened to most people. And it hasn't happened to them willingly. It's happened because they're a product of the culture. And if you start watching movies or paying attention to what's going on in these, that you'll see these kind of epistemologies behind it, behind kind of what the world has been pitching as a worldview. So what should our approach be? All right, I'm going to finish with this. So our approach I would call Christian foundationalism, and I'm going to ground it in a guy named Anselm, who was a saint of the church in the 12th century. Brilliant man. He's actually a precursor to Aquinas and built on a lot of the work that Augustine did in the 4th century. But he wrote extensively on this idea of how should we pursue knowledge and wisdom, and his kind of catchword is faith seeking understanding. Okay? And this is my favorite quote of that kind of epistemology. It's from C.S. Lewis. I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen. not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. Okay? So what he's saying is that I don't believe in Christianity because I've empirically verified Christianity as much as Christianity shows me everything else. Okay? It's that way that it functions in order to validate itself.
Could you say that one more time? I got lost in that.
Yeah, okay. So I don't believe in Christianity because I've looked at just Christianity. I've just studied it as a set of facts or I've studied it with my senses, but I believe in it because of the light it sheds on everything else. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you some biblical examples of that. Does anybody have a Bible or a Bible on your phone? Want to look these up? I'll do Proverbs 9. So if somebody can do Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Somebody else, Romans 1, 20 through 21. Okay, so Proverbs 9, 10 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The knowledge of the Holy One is insight." Now that phrase, "the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom," occurs 5 times in the Old Testament. And the fear of the Lord, we talked about this a little while ago, is a proper posture before God. And he says that's the foundation stone of wisdom. Okay? So we talked a little bit before about empiricism being seeing is believing. Christians would say believing is seeing. And this is, I'm going to have to work on this because it sounds, you know, to our culture, it's like, what? No. You know, that's not, you got this backwards. But believing is seeing. Now, what I mean by that is if we adopt belief in God and Christ as a foundational view and then see the world through that, on top of that foundation, it has greater interpretive power of reality than any other foundational view, right? So foundationalism, remember, was an epistemology that says you have to have certain presuppositions, you have to have certain things that you assume are true about reality as a starting point to build truth, right? You have to have some foundational basic beliefs. And this is what Plantinga said. He said belief in God is a proper basic belief. And he proved that through logical and analytical philosophy, that it's a proper basic belief. In other words, it's warranted because of the interpretive power that it produces. And this is what the scriptures say, that accepting God as reality is the foundation of that. Somebody read Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. We know this verse, but if anybody has it.
Sorry.
Yes?
However, they do claim that no absolute truth is an absolute truth.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah. So there's a lot of inside relativism. There's a lot of contradiction. Yeah. Somebody have it? I can read it.
I have it.
Okay. Great.
Trust the Lord with all your heart, and do not rely on your own understanding. And in all your ways, know Him, and He will make your path straight.
Okay. So, trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your understanding. Now, so that you don't think that this is a derogatory verse about understanding. The whole book of Proverbs is, please gain understanding, gain wisdom, seek for it, get as much understanding as you can, but don't lean on it. In other words, it's not a proper foundation for you. Now, the irony of Descartes all the way through, the history that we walk through, is that's really what they figured out, that our minds are not able to build by themselves a strong foundation for truth because we're too easily deceived, we're too finite, we're too broken to do that. And the Bible's been saying that the whole time. Like, this is a bad thing to lean on, but understanding is great. And where does it come from? When you trust in the Lord, your way becomes clear. So he's saying the understanding of what my life should be becomes clear once I accept God as a foundational belief. Okay? Now, it doesn't mean there's no place for saying, well, is belief in God reasonable or rational? Of course, there's a place for that, especially in dialogue with people who don't yet believe. But at some point, you have to tell this person, I can't prove this to you empirically, but what I can tell you is if you start looking at reality with God and Christ as the foundation, all of reality is going to make more sense to you, I believe, than it does without Him. And that's what we have to think about. Okay, last one. Does somebody have that one? Romans 1, 20 and 21.
For his invisible attributes, that is, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen since the creation of the world, being understood through what he has made. And as a result, people are without excuse. For though they knew God, they did not glorify him as God or show gratitude. Instead, their thinking became worthless and their senseless hearts were darkened.
Okay, so the other thing the Bible tells us is we're not unbiased, rational machines. Okay? Our brains have something wrong with them. So that passage basically says, if we saw the right, if we saw the created order as an unbiased computer, right, we would conclude that there's a powerful God or first cause behind it, because his divine power is clearly seen in the things that have been made. Now, we wouldn't know anything about him. We wouldn't know he loves us. We wouldn't know he's personal. We wouldn't know something. But we would look at it and go, yeah, there's a first cause. Something's behind this. But we're not that way. We're biased because we exchanged the glory of God for our own avenues of worship. And so our hearts were darkened. Now, we're going to see later that there are some brilliant atheists that know this about themselves. You know, they wrestle with, I don't believe theism, and they say, I see why some people do, but I can't do it. And then if they're honest, they'll say, the reason I can't do it is because I don't want some God telling me about sexual ethics. Oh, so you're not really just a cold rationalist. You have skin in the game. You have a lifestyle you want to preserve. Augustine was that way when he was trying to come to faith. He saw the beauty of Christ, but he had a concubine that he deeply loved, and he knew that that wasn't allowed. So it kept him from faith for a long time. So the Bible tells us that we're not kind of unbiased thinkers. We're biased by the fallen nature that we have. So we can't put our foundation stone, our own rationality, right, or our own empirical evidence. Make sense? So the reason I did all of this groundwork is because every question we're going to talk about, you have to understand that this is our epistemology. This is how we establish truth. Is that, assuming there's a God, assuming Christ is true, let's talk about how we wrestle with this particular thing upon that foundation. We can't go back and reinvent it and say, let me tell you how it's true for you if you're a relativist. Or let me tell you how through pure empirical evidence this will be true. Right? We can't do that. And so we can't cater to other people's epistemologies. Right? We have to say, this is what we do. You can't prove God just by your senses and things like that. But if you build your life on God, it'll make all of creation make more sense. Okay? All right. So that's the foundation for what we're going to do. Your sheets, if you've marked those up, please leave those on the table back here or back here on the way out. And I'll compile those. And next week we'll start on whatever the most popular questions are. All right. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for a chance to think deeply together. And I know this was kind of heavy lifting to talk about these things, but yeah, this is one of the things that separates us from a lost world, is that we think differently about truth. And so I pray that this will be helpful. I pray that even as we've spoken, that you would put people on the hearts of the people in this room, that they know, I've had a conversation like that. And I know my friend is like that. And it would inspire them to engage that person and to start listening to them and how they understand the world. And it would open avenues, God, for us to share your love and your truth with others. It's in Christ's name I pray. Amen.